This is Reek Talk, episode 122, for October 2nd, 2007. This is Reek Talk, and I'm your host, Anatole Pavlin. My co-host today is Samantha Rowan from Real Estate Finance Investment. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Anatole.
Now, joining us today is Tad Phillip, Managing Director in the Commercial Mortgage Finance Group at Moody's. Now, before Tad joins us, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of ReTalk is sponsored by Real Foundations, delivering world-class business improvement, process optimization, and technology solutions to real estate investors and operators. Real Foundations has years of experience working with leading REITs and institutional investors. For more information on their breadth of services and expertise, visit Real Foundations on the internet at www.realfoundations.net. This program is also sponsored by the law firm of Pepper Hamilton. Pepper Hamilton is a multi-practice law firm whose reputation for results goes back more than a century. To learn more about Pepper Hamilton and their real estate capital markets practice, you can visit them on the internet at www.pepperlaw.com. ReTalk is also sponsored by Ashford Hospitality Trust, the premier capital provider to the hospitality industry. Ashford invests across all hotel segments and all levels of the capital structure. For more information on Ashford's investment strategy and its full range of hotel capital solutions, you can visit them on the internet at www.ahtreit.com. You can find links to our sponsors in the program notes that accompany this podcast, as well as on the REIT Talk page at REITcafe.com. Our sponsors are important to us since they do make REIT Cafe and many podcasts, including REIT Talk, possible. And with that important message behind us, I'd like to welcome today's guest. Tad, welcome to REIT Talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Tad, we've spoken with John Kriz a number of times on our programs. Can you tell us about your group's responsibilities and how that differs from what John's group does?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Moody's has two primary divisions, structured finance and corporate finance. John and the REIT team are in the corporate finance group, which relates to the unsecured obligations of corporate borrowers. I am in the structured finance group, which relates to asset-backed securities, in my case, backed by commercial properties.
Okay.
So that's the big difference.
And does your group handle residential as well, or just the commercial?
The structured finance group overall does. I'm responsible only for commercial.
Okay.
Also, one of the things that we wanted to talk about today is that Moody's recently joined forces with Real Estate Analytics to launch a new index. Could you tell us a little bit about the index, how Moody's got involved, and why it was launched?
Sure. Well, I guess we started looking into the index space more than a year ago, and I noticed a couple of things. One, that commercial property derivatives were beginning to trade in Britain, and then secondly, that there was the opportunity for indices here in the U.S., that the U.S. commercial property market seemed like one of the largest unserved markets by active derivatives trading. So, you know, we started looking into here at Moody's, you know, what could we do, you know, something that we would want to be involved with that would be reliable, timely, that we would be willing to put our brand on. So started down that path and ultimately led us to where we are today.
Now, when you look at derivatives, particularly in the commercial real estate sector, what are the advantages to investors?
Well, there's potentially quite a few. You know, it's interesting in a way that derivatives started in the U.S. 150 years ago with farmers hedging the value of corn. So it's interesting that farmers got ahead of real estate developers by 150 years. But there's some, I mention that only because there's parallels that farmers want to get paid for what they know how to do. You know, they plant corn, and in the fall they want to harvest it and get their money, but they don't want to take market risk. Like, what if the market for corn is up or down? And real estate developers can do the same thing. They can decide to build a building now, except it won't be delivered perhaps for 2 years. And how do they assure they get paid for the expertise they have without running market value risk,
Okay. Which
is especially an issue at times like this. And by the same token, you can have portfolio managers, people who own, you know, equities or loans on hundreds of properties around the country, and from time to time their views may change. They want to be more in some markets and less in others, but the time it takes to actually make loans or sell buildings and the cost can be material, where you can more quickly move in and out of exposures using derivatives.
Now, there have been some derivatives set up here already in the U.S. using the NCREIF index.
Mm-hmm.
What are the major differences between what you're doing and what the NCREIF index is doing?
Well, there's a couple of main differences. The NCREIF index, which we have a lot of respect for and is a long-term series with a lot of value, is appraisal-based on pension fund assets. So it's a different data set and a different methodology than we're using. And ours is based on transactions, which in an ideal world is what you would base an index on. Probably the best indices are the ones tied to the stock market, where you have frequent public trading of similar assets. The challenge in commercial real estate is the assets are more unique, and they trade, you know, every few years rather than every few seconds. So real estate clearly has a different set of issues around trying to build an index. And for those who want to trade derivatives tied to an index, you want it to be timely and you want it to be accurate. Because if you buy a one-year contract, you wouldn't really want to see an index that lagged what was happening in the market by several quarters. So we think that's one of the advantages of our index, is that the data is gathered by Real Capital Analytics, which is, we believe, the largest and best vendor of property sales data. We put it in our regression model as soon as we can get it, which shows us where the market has moved recently. Those same transactions would take several months to find their way into an appraisal, and then perhaps several more months to find their way into the NCREIF index. So we believe, possibly including over the next few months, our index might show a decline while other indices still might be showing the market going up, because we think we're near an inflection point in the market, and it's a good time to have an index that will capture that as accurately and quickly as possible.
All right, well, you raised an interesting point in your answer, and that's that real estate isn't like securities, doesn't trade all the time.
Right.
How do you handle a repeat sales index when the transactions are so few and far between?
Well, that's the key to our relationship with Real Capital Analytics. They capture, we believe, over 90% of all the property sales in the U.S. Above $2.5 million. So, other indices like the NCREIF maybe have a data set about one-tenth the size, which is assets managed on behalf of the pension fund community. So we have pretty much at our disposal the entire set of property transactions across the U.S. For properties of all sizes and all locations.
Mm-hmm.
And the other major issue you have to deal with is, properties can be as different as a townhouse or Rockefeller Center or a Kmart or Mall of the Americas. So how do you match them up? Which is why we try to use the repeat sale regression methodology. So we look at a property that was sold within the last month or two and then find out when it was last sold, and then put these hundreds of data points into a regression model, which derives the current rate of change. So that takes out of play a lot of the issues. And of course, as you might imagine, there's a significant filtering process before the data goes in the model. So we check to make sure the address of the property is the same, the use of the property is the same, so it wasn't a warehouse turned into a hotel, that the square footage is the same, so it wasn't 150,000 feet, now it's 200, so the value increases because of a new wing being added. So, we go through a very extensive quality control process and then ultimately put the data into the model. And in almost all cases, we have designed the various 29 subsets so that we think we will most often have at least 100 pairs of trades on which to calculate the index, because any handful of trades could be skewed for various reasons, such as what's happening with tenants or what's happening with financings. But across hundreds of trades, those things tend to work themselves out.
Okay.
And in fact, they reflect the chaos that's part of the market. A buildings are turning into B buildings are turning into A buildings. People buy a building empty and sell it full. They buy it full and sell it empty. So that's all part of what's happening in the market, and so we're trying to let the market be the market and capture what it's telling us.
Also, another question that we're interested in is how ownership and financing structures will affect transactions. As we all know, that ownership and financing structures are important to how a property is valued, And how does the index account for differences in financing a property every time it trades?
Well, that's ultimately baked into the purchase price. And so there's basically two major components of property value, and one is what's happening in the property markets, and the other is what's happening in the capital markets. You know, it's our view that the liquidity crunch is going to lead to higher cap rates, and that will be caused by higher borrowing costs, that the 10-year Treasury is still about the same as it was pre-liquidity crunch, but now lenders are looking for a higher spread. And if borrowers are paying, like if 75% of the cost of acquisition is borrowing money and that cost went up, ultimately that filters through. So what's happening in the capital markets is an important variable. The other important variable is what's happening in the property markets with supply and demand, and is that making rents go up or rents go down? So at various points in time, you might have the property markets working in one direction and the capital markets in the other, or vice versa. So all that is it's baked in, and importantly, you know, it is what it is, where, you know, the appraisal process can introduce an element of opinion that, well, here's the market now, but we think it will be different in a few years. Mm-hmm. In fact, frequently what appraisals include is, projections of where the property market will be 5 years ago with an exit cap rate, you know, and the growth rate for rents. And, you know, ultimately all those kinds of things are baked into purchase price decisions. If somebody buys a building, they're looking at their cost of financing, they're looking at what they think they can do with rents and expenses. So it's a lot more, you know, complicated process than, let's say, you know, maybe simplistically, corn is corn and oil is oil and gold is gold, you know, in terms of measuring price changes in those sectors. Real estate has a lot more moving parts. You know, so we recognize it has the limitations of unique assets that trade at infrequent periods, but we think, you know, recognizing those flaws, we've done the best that can be done to capture the movements.
Now, when you look at the transaction flow that's out there, how close do you get to the actual participants in this index? I mean, you follow these markets. You're opining on the debt. How close in do you get to that information? I mean, I know you understand. I understand you guys are doing the quality control there, but how much deeper do you guys go?
Well, yeah, there's an important firewall. There's a company called REAL, mm-hmm. the Real Estate Analytics LLC, that's going to make a market based on the index, and they're going to find people who have different opinions of different markets and want to act on it. So somebody might want to be long New York and somebody might want to be short. Or even if you both agree in the same direction, you think New York's going up, one might think it's going up more than another and a deal can be struck.
Mm-hmm.
But this company, REAL, is involved with the trading, the derivatives, and mm-hmm. Moody's, for a variety of reasons, has no involvement and no interest involvement in that space. So we are basically the calculation and distribution agent.
Mm-hmm.
And an important part of having an index for which derivatives will be traded is to have an objective third party calculate it, somebody that traders think will be unbiased and around over many, many years, so that, you know, if you have a forward contract of some years, you want to know that it'll be calculated fairly and over time, you know, with an entity that'll be around.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our role. And so we're not part of the trading process. We're not going to know which parties are trading or what their motives are. That being said, I think interesting information will become available, as it has in other sectors, as a result of the trading.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you can distill market sentiment from where derivatives trade. And I've heard already from some NCREIF trading that some markets, let's say Florida apartments, are trading at a negative basis. So the market sentiment is that the value will go down and the price is struck by how much the parties think it will go down. And other markets are currently being priced by how much they'll go up, like 5 or 6%. So it'll be, you know, it'll be, I think, producing some interesting side information and quantitative tools, you know, based on market sentiment, which we and others may or may not agree with, but it will be there to observe.
And also, you know, with everything that's happened over this past year, with the subprime meltdown, there's been a lot of political scrutiny, for lack of a better term, of the rating agencies in terms of, you know, the views on and how they've been following the mortgages, rightly or wrongly. When you introduce an index like this, I mean, what are you hearing from folks as you go to introduce this? I mean, is there a concern that this raises volatility or reduces volatility? What are you hearing?
Well, for now, there's been very limited trading on any of the U.S. indices. I think there's been a little bit of trading on NCREIF, and trading on the Moody's Real Index is just about to start. It's an interesting question. I went to a conference last week where the professor who designed the methodology, David Geltner from MIT, described our model as a Ferrari, and it can be driven at 30 miles an hour to the supermarket, or it can be driven at 200 miles an hour down the highway, passing cars left and right. So it's a lot of it's about how it's used. And the main purpose of indices and derivatives based on them is risk management.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very clear from the earnings reports from the Wall Street over the last few weeks that some firms are much better at risk management than others, you know, through a turbulent period. So while the intention is to make a tool available for risk management, that if you're overexposed to some sector, you can quickly hedge yourself, there is the distinct possibility that these tools can also be used by speculators to just purely be based, make bets based on direction rather than hedging specific portfolios they have. So, so like a lot of tools, it can be used in multiple ways.
Well, it's interesting that you have David Geltner on this. He was pretty heavily involved with the NCREIF index.
I'm not terribly sure, honestly, about his role there, but he is the architect of the regression sales model that we use to run the RCA data, and we have a lot of respect and confidence in David.
To shift a little bit away from talk about the index, I'd like to talk a little bit about how in March Moody's took a stand against deteriorating underwriting standards in CMBS. Ted, could you tell us a little bit what was behind this move and what's happened to the market since you did this, both at Moody's and in the broader commercial real estate market?
Sure. Well, first, let's back up a second. The intention of ratings is to be forward-looking assessments of risk. And while it's much easier to look backwards, that can lead to missing major credit signals. And last spring, maybe around the time of when the Yankees were in spring training, I was thinking about what Yogi Berra once said, you know, which is the future is not what it used to be. And my concern, or the concern of Moody's, is that underwriting was getting weaker at a time that the market is peaking. And I think if history shows anything, it's that different vintages have different loss contents. And frequently, at the bottom of a market, you also have good underwriting, which means lower losses. And at the peak of a market, and frequently at the peak of the market, you have 5 or 6 years of no losses. People get overconfident. They start doing more aggressive underwriting. There's more losses. So in a perfect world, credit supports would move up and down on a fairly fluid basis in anticipation of where you're going rather than in reaction to where you've just been. And in the late 1990s, Moody's was actually the first ones to move credit supports lower because we thought that the underwriting was good and we were near the bottom of a cycle. What's interesting at the time is another rating agency accused us of doing the credit support limbo and how low will we go. But ultimately, they followed our lead and came along and subsequently most often were lower than us, notwithstanding their initial criticism. And now we believe we're at another inflection point in the market, this time nearing a peak, and we're the first to raise again, and once again the other ones are sitting on the sidelines observing what's happening. And the consequence to us, my particular group is transactions-based. You know, we make our money rating transactions, and our market share plummeted. And instead of rating 75% of the deals, we started to miss 75% of the deals because we looked for higher subordination for a given rating, and issuers went elsewhere. So that was the initial pain we experienced. However, I think there's, you know, we're beginning to see some positive results. First, investors, I think, accept what we're doing, and Moody's rated bonds trade better than ones that we're not on, so we're beginning to get on more transactions even when we're seeking higher subordination. And the other thing is, I think, our message resonated with underwriters who are reluctant to bring poorly underwritten loans to market. So the combination of better underwritten loans coming to deals and at least Moody's rated deals having higher subordination is helping us correctly position CMBS for where it is in the market. So it's a very painful process to go through, I can tell you that. Largely because so many people in the market are backwards looking, and you're trying to make a move based on the future without the context of all hell breaking loose with delinquencies. And that's not what I'm trying to accomplish. So I'd rather anticipate credit problems rather than react to them. And so it's not easy to anticipate them, but it's worse to react to them. So that's what I'm very much trying to avoid.
So you found then that your market share is rebounding as everything kind of works its way through the market?
It's come back a little bit, but it's far from where it used to be. Mm-hmm. Although I'm beginning to see more and more street research saying that Moody's bonds are trading better and better, and more mm-hmm. investors are coming on board. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's what the investment bankers respond to, is if people pay up for something.
Mm-hmm.
And investors are beginning to pay up for Moody's ratings, understanding that we're doing something differently than the others. And, so that's beginning to turn the tide. But in a way, it's almost like an election where we're trying to turn the tide of public opinion and being elected by bondholders to rate the deals. That when they pay a tighter spread, ultimately then the investment bankers do their bond math and conclude it's better to have us on, even if we're looking for a little bit more subordination.
Well, Tad, the sort of the dislocation in the credit markets here in the U.S. has definitely had an impact on the economy and on the U.S. dollar, which is now trading at historically low levels. What implications does that have on commercial real estate debt markets in the United States?
Well, commercial real estate is very much capital intensive, and I think I might have mentioned earlier in our discussion, when people go to buy a building, 75% or more of the acquisition price is tied to the cost of debt.
Mm-hmm.
And if the cost of debt goes up, it ultimately drives the price of existing buildings down. And yeah, so that's something we're keeping a watchful eye on. I think the market certainly applauded the Federal Reserve move of 50 basis points, and you can see the stock market at a new high. But, excuse me. That very much drives the short end of the yield curve, mm-hmm. where commercial real estate typically is a long-term hold of 5 to 10 years, and it's the long end of the yield curve that drives real estate value, and that ultimately is tied to the 10-year Treasury, which in large part is tied to investors' expectations about future inflation and how well that's being managed. So, you know, it's all part of a complex and interconnected financial system that the Fed in particular has to manage the competing objectives of trying to keep the economy stimulated, which a rate cut does, with mm-hmm. trying to manage long-term confidence in the bond market, which raises the specter of inflation. So, we think they're doing an admirable job, but it's something that, we and others in the real estate sector have to keep a close watch on.
And also, another thing I'm curious about is how the CRE CDO market is doing right now. As we know, it was pretty active in the first part of the year and pretty much came to a halt, I think, after a couple of deals were priced in July. Are you starting to see any signs of life in that market, or is it still kind of quiet?
Yeah, unfortunately, the commercial real estate CDO market has suffered a serious dislocation,
mm-hmm.
almost entirely related to subprime spillover.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually quite comfortable with the ratings on CRE CDOs, and our seeking additional enhancement was relating to CMBS, not them. So it's ironic in a way, and we think it will take at least several quarters to recover.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame for a couple of reasons. First, CRE CDOs is how the buyers of junior bonds finance themselves with mm-hmm. long-term matched funding. Like if you buy a 10-year CMBS junior bond, you can do a CDO that matches that, as opposed to having short-term funding that exposes you to liquidity crunch. Mm-hmm. And I think, like I mentioned, we feel pretty confident in CDO ratings. So unfortunately, I think the initial CDO were compromised by perhaps some other collateral that was put into some other deals that didn't perform so well. So it's not so much the vehicle that's the issue, it's how they're managed and what goes into them. So we do think they'll come back, but there's quite a linkage that works backwards that needs to be solved, which is the CDOs in large part are sold to structured investment vehicles in Europe, mm-hmm. which finance themselves with asset-backed commercial paper, which need bank lines for liquidity reasons. And so mm-hmm. ultimately, I think the banks are marshaling their credit lines, which is shutting down or limiting the asset-backed commercial paper market, which is limiting the structured investment vehicles, which is limiting the CDOs, which is putting a squeeze on CMBS. So
right.
it's kind of interesting to, you know, when you hear how, you know, complex and international the market is, that you're thinking, gee, why is the cost of a office building in Kansas City linked to a structured vehicle in London that has trouble with its CP program? But ultimately it is.
Mm-hmm.
So the good news is, you know, that you know, the capital markets usually can make capital available and efficiently, but periodically they suffer disruptions like the one we're going through. And I know the street is, you know, on an active quest to try to find you know, new investors and new funding sources to replace the ones that have at least temporarily stepped back.
Are they having any luck with that, or is it still kind of they're still looking?
It's still kind of early. Mm-hmm. The U.S. commercial mortgage market, the securitized portion, has grown to be quite large. I mean, last year it was on the order of $200 billion. The run rate at the moment is down by at least 75%. So, so that's an enormous void to fill, and banks and life companies aren't going to be able to do it because banks are under close scrutiny by regulators because their real estate portion of their balance sheet is at all-time high levels. And life companies have very specific match funding issues where they have a certain number of college professors retiring in 10 years. Mm-hmm. They need a certain number of 10-year mortgages to line up with that. And then even if spreads, you know, gap out to attractive levels, that doesn't mean they're going to you know, step up their acquisitions. So I think what's been missing is sort of the leveraged players that they can kind of take on more leverage and buy more or buy less as opportunities arise. And so because of the liquidity crunch, it's the leveraged players who've left the CMBS space and left quite a void that's not going to be so easy to fill.
So, Tad, are we seeing the light at the end of the tunnel?
I think there are some positive signs. And as often is the case, it starts at the top and works its way down. So AAA spreads have begun to firm up, so they've been widening, you know, meaningfully for a while. But for the last couple of deals, they've sort of settled into a new, albeit higher, trading range.
Right.
And now you have to start stabilizing the double A's and the single A's. And ultimately, you know, the further you go down the capital structure, the more risk there is and the more unstable the pricing is. But a important first step is taken in stabilizing the AAA portion, which is the frequently the largest portion of the capital stack of 70 or 80%. So there are some signs that the corner is being turned. But again, CDOs played an important part of placing the middle and bottom of the capital structure. And that market we don't see coming back for several quarters. So while the market is solidifying at the top, it's still problematic at the bottom, and many in the CMBS space view the transactions as a trade where you make a pool of loans and then you sell bonds, recharge your capital, and do it again. But unless you can sell all the bonds top to bottom, you're stuck from going out and making a new batch of loans. So because the middle to bottom part of the capital structure is still very choppy, it's put a crimp on the production pipelines of securitized loans.
Now, is anybody emerging as a buyer for those?
I think some of the B buyers are fortunate, and they had recharged their capital shortly before the liquidity crunch, and they're now able to drive better terms, both in getting a higher yield and kicking out more of the loans not to their liking. And this is very reminiscent of the fall of 98, where the biggest buyer at the time got caught in a liquidity squeeze because they had financed their long-term mortgages with short-term commercial paper and had their funding yanked, and then all of a sudden the balance of power shifted to the B buyer community. So I'm not aware of a lot of new entrants into the space, which I think is one of the great ironies in the finance business, that when investing opportunities are the greatest, capital is hardest to find, and when investment opportunities are limited, capital is plentiful. So so now the challenge has shifted that there are good opportunities out there for those who can raise capital. So I'm aware of, I guess, some efforts to raise opportunistic funds, and of course, again, the challenge is you're doing it with all the background noise, trying to get people to come in. It may actually be a good time to do so, because you can get well-structured loans at good prices.
Well, Tad, appreciate you taking the time here and walking us through your new index, and also giving us some insight into the tumultuous commercial debt markets today.
Well, thank you for having me on the program, and hopefully next time we speak, the markets will be a little less tumultuous.
We can only hope.
They seem a little better, so.
Now, before I get to my closing comments, I did want to remind listeners that this episode of Retalk has been sponsored by the law firm of Pepper Hamilton. Pepper Hamilton is a multi-practice law firm whose reputation for results goes back more than a century. To learn more about Pepper Hamilton and their real estate capital markets practice, you can visit them on the internet at www.pepperlaw.com. This program is also sponsored by Real Foundations, delivering world-class business improvement, process optimization, and technology solutions to real estate investors and operators. Real Foundations has years of experience working with leading REITs and institutional investors. For more information on their breadth of services and expertise, visit Real Foundations on the internet at www.realfoundations.net. Retalk is also sponsored by Ashford Hospitality Trust, the premier capital provider to the hospitality industry. Ashford invests across all hotel segments and all levels of the capital structure. For more information on Ashford's investment strategy and its full range of hotel capital solutions, you can visit them on the internet at www.ahtreit.com. You can find links to our sponsors in the program notes that accompany this podcast, as well as on the REIT Talk page at REITcafe.com. Finally, I'd like to thank Derek K. Miller from Vancouver, Canada, for providing the music for this episode of REIT Talk. I'm Anatole Pevnev, and this has been REIT Talk. Thanks for listening.